So we're going to look at tonight John chapter 5, the healing of the impotent man at the pool of Bethesda. Now we concluded last time by looking at verse 1 regarding the feast of the Jews, and we mentioned the fact that if the feast of verse 1 was Passover, then the Gospel of John records the four Passovers of the Lord's 3.5 years ministry. And we had plenty of discussion on it afterwards, and I've not heard to the contrary that anybody's come up with a better idea. So we're going to make the assumption and proceed on the basis that chapter 5 and verse 1 was the second Passover of the Lord's ministry. So that a whole year transpires through chapter 5 till we come to chapter 6 and verse 4 when we have the third Passover. I believe there's an appropriateness to the fact that it was the Passover. Now I'm sure we all know about the incident of the impotent man, but if I can just read the first few verses so that we will get the gist of the narrative fixed in our minds again. After this there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is at Jerusalem by the sheep market a pool, which is called in the Hebrew tongue Bethesda, having 5 porches. In these lay a great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain season into the pool and troubled the water. Whosoever then first after the troubling of the water stepped in was made whole of whatsoever disease he had. And a certain man was there which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he said unto him, Wilt thou be made whole? And the impotent man answered him, Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool, but while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Jesus saith unto him, Rise, take up thy bed, and walk. And immediately the man was made whole, and took up his bed, and walked, and on the same day was the Sabbath. So that's the incident, which is the third sign, as far as the Gospel of John is concerned. You recall there was 8 signs, 8 miracles, which are performed throughout the Gospel, and this was the third one. Now, I'm going to suggest, we've probably got to put our thinking caps on tonight, so it's one of those sort of chapters and few verses which is an either-or. It can be translated or understood in one way or another. And it's very difficult, well, difficult for me anyway, to determine which way is the correct interpretation. So I'm going to put the either-ors. I'll also give you my feelings as to which one it ought to be, but perhaps we'll have the benefit of all your knowledge and thoughts later on in the discussion. So first of all, we come to the place where this miracle took place at, which is described in verse 2 at being as Jerusalem by the sheep market. Well, if you'll notice in the margin, sheep gate. And there was a pool which in the Hebrew tongue was called Bethesda. And the word Bethesda means house of mercy or house of kindness. Now again, there are 2 basic opinions as to where this pool was. If you go back to the book of Nehemiah and chapter 3, I think it's fairly clear from Nehemiah that the sheep gate was on the east side of the city near to the temple precinct. Because in Nehemiah chapter 3, Nehemiah mentions the sheep gate in verse 1. Then Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brethren the priest, and they builded the sheep gate. They sanctified it and set up the doors of it, even to the tower of Mir. They sanctified it unto the tower of Hananiel. And if you go over to the 12th chapter of the same book, Nehemiah chapter 12, and verse 39, and from above the gate of Ephraim, and above the old gate, and above the fish gate, and the tower of Hananiel, and the tower of Mia, even unto the sheep gate, and they stood still in the prison gate. And although Herod's temple was now built upon the site, nevertheless he followed the pattern of the one which had built following the exile, and therefore the sheep gate was on the east side near the temple, and it was the gate through which the animals who were going to be offered for sacrifice at the temple were brought through. Now, that is fairly easy to determine, but it's where the pool was in relationship to the sheep gate which is the difficulty. Some say that it was, which is known today as the Virgin's Fountain, which lay in the Kidron Valley, southeast from the Temple Hill. And I read an extract from one of the researchers on this matter. Early writers and travellers in Palestine have commented on the phenomena where a sudden, unexplained uprush of water from time to time has been seen. Some have added that a spring in the temple area used to drain through the underground strata to the Virgin's Fountain, the water sometimes reddened by the blood of the sacrifice. And that is a quote from Eusebius, who of course was the ecclesiastical historian. And he suggests therefore that it was the Virgin's Fountain, and that the pool was sometimes red because of the blood which had drained from the place where the animals had been sacrificed. If that's the case, then it was to the southeast of the temple in the Kidron Valley. Others, and predominantly more of them, say it was the north of the Temple Hill, and it was a large reservoir which is today called Birket Israel. And it was a reservoir which was 360 feet long, 120 feet wide, and 80 feet deep. And it was there where this gushing of the water happened. Although they have discovered various places around Jerusalem which have got arches which would seem to indicate the five porches of verse 2, none of them are linked directly with the pool. So archaeologists and historians and people who have researched this seem to be in a dilemma as to exactly where Bethesda was. What we are sure of, that it was near the sheep gate. So it was in the precinct of the temple. Whether it was to the southeast or to the north, really, I don't suppose matters a great deal. But it's an either-or situation. It was either the Virgin's Fountain or it was this great reservoir. But it was by that pool that lay these great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. Now, of course, again, there has been a lot of speculation concerning the moving of the water. Verse 4 says, an angel went down at a certain season into the pool. And therefore there are three alternatives for you to consider. Firstly, that it was, as it is stated, an angel. That at a certain time, at a certain season, an angel of God troubled the water in order for a cure to take place. Secondly, as was suggested by Eusebius, that basically it was a natural phenomena with a sudden gushing of water, like you do get in certain parts of the world, and within this gushing of water there was medicinal properties which could heal people. Or thirdly, as Bullinger makes the point in the Companion Bible, that the real translation of verse 4 ought to be, for it was said an angel went down at a certain season. And he suggests that it was a superstition on behalf of the Jews that either caused by wind or some other natural event, the waters moved, and the people just happened to believe that an angel had caused the waters to move, and whoever was first in was cured. In other words, it was one of those things which is called mind over matter. There was nothing of a healing property within the water. There was nothing sort of magical or even from a divine point of view miraculous. It was just the fact that they believed that they would be cured, and they became cured. So, we either believe it was an angel, or that it was a natural phenomena, or it was a superstition of the Jews, and therefore the translation of verse 4 should read, "For it was seen." There is no justification for altering the text. You can look at all the alternatives, and there is no justification at all for suggesting what Bullinger just said. Superstition was very rife amongst the Jews, and therefore it could well have been the case. Something which you might like to consider with me in verse 7. When in the discussion with the master, the impotent man said, "Sir, I have no man, when the water is troubled, to put me into the pool, but while I am coming, another steppeth down before me." As if only one person at this given time when the waters moved could be cured. Now again, if it was something of a mind over matter, you'd think they'd sort of all jump in. But there is an indication that only one person was cured at any particular time. Again, if it was a natural phenomena with medicinal properties in the gushing of the water, you would have thought that more would have been cured at that given time. Which leads you to conclude, perhaps, that if it was only one to be cured, it was the mercy of God who was prepared at a given time, for a particular reason we know not, to provide a cure for a person who went into the water. Now again, this will test our own knowledge of the scriptures. I don't know of a precedent which has been set in the past for that to happen. I've sort of thought deep and long about the Old Testament, and I can't think of a precedent in the Old Testament where God has worked upon that basis. He's always expected a response on behalf of an individual, or at least an act of faith in some respect, before he would perform a miracle of any sort. And therefore, if it was an angel, as verse 4 does read, and is confirmed by every translation you want to look at, then, you know, for some reason, a precedent has been set, and God was prepared to send an angel for this particular happening. Now, obviously, the Almighty manipulated many events and many circumstances to come together to provide the basis of the ministry of the Lord's life. And therefore, in order for this miracle to be performed, it may well have been that the Almighty was prepared to organise these things to be happening for a number of years so that the Master could make the play upon it. I don't see the Almighty working in that way. That's just a personal opinion, but as I said at the beginning, this is for us perhaps to discuss later. My personal opinion is that it was a natural phenomena, and that there was only a room for one person to go into the pool at any given time. And I personally feel that the pool was linked with the sheep gate, because that's what verse 2 tells us. And there was in the sheep gate, or near the sheep gate, a pool where they used to dip the animals in to clean them, to cleanse them, before they sacrificed them. And I personally feel that this was now used for this particular event, this particular happening. And whether it was a gushing of the waters, a spring which gushed up, or whatever, and it was something which is a natural phenomena, which with mind over matter then, people believed would effect a cure, and it did. And I'm personally of the persuasion, although I'm not categoric by any means, it is more likely to be something like that, where only one person could go in at one time, and something happened which stirred the waters up, and people believed it would effect a cure. And in a different way, but in a similar sense, we have the evangelical movements today with the faith healing, where people get whipped up into a frenzy and they sometimes feel that they've been cured of a particular happening. And I'm more inclined to think that way than an angel or anything else. But again, for you to think about. What I do believe is important is that by it, in verse 3, lay this great multitude of impotent folk, of blind, halt, withered, waiting for the moving of the water. Now, if you look at Ephesians chapter 2, these folk obviously had natural ailments as well as spiritual ones. If we think of the spiritual one in chapter 2 and verse 1 of Ephesians, where Paul says, "You hath he quickened who were dead in trespasses and sins. And therefore, wherein in time past you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air, the spirit that worketh in the children of disobedience, among whom also we all had our conversation in time past, in the lusts of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature the children of wrath, even as others." Verse 5, "Even when we were dead in sins, hath he quickened us together with Christ, by grace you are saved." And therefore, in verse 3 of John chapter 5, these people, this great multitude of impotent folk, blind, halt, withered, all in need of God's mercy and grace, which perhaps is personified by the fact that Bethesda had five porches. Five being the number significant with grace. And Paul goes on to speak in verse 8 of Ephesians chapter 2, "For by grace are you saved through faith." And therefore they were not able to effect a cure. And without the love and the mercy and the grace of God, we likewise are not able to effect a cure for our ailment, sin and the effects of it upon the body. And therefore we are reliant totally upon the grace and mercy of God. And so in principle were these folk. And therefore without the presence of the Lord Jesus Christ coming amongst them, then most of them would end their life awaiting a cure. But you'll notice if we come back to John chapter 5, that as the Master came into this situation, there was a certain man there which had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lie and knew that he had been now a long time in that case, he said unto him, "Wilt thou be made whole?" Now verse 3 tells us there was a great multitude of people in need. But the Master zones in on one person only. He doesn't cure them all. He doesn't say to them all, "Do you want to be healed?" He doesn't try and help the others. He zones in particularly upon this man. And I think there's a great reason, a great lesson for it. Because it's not without its significance that this man had had an infirmity for 38 years. And I don't think you need to be reminding, but you might like to put a note in your margin, to Deuteronomy chapter 2 and verse 14. Because the significance of 38 years takes us back to the wanderings of the children of Israel. Because in verse 14 of Deuteronomy 2, "And the space in which we came from Kadesh Barnea until we come over the brook Zered was 38 years. And to all the generation of the men of war were wasted out from among the hosts as the Lord sware unto them." Now if you recall, we normally think of the wanderings of the children of Israel as being 40 years. But of course they came down into Sinai after they had crossed the Red Sea, and they were in Sinai approximately 18 months. It was an 11-day journey from Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. And Kadesh Barnea, which is mentioned here in verse 14, was where they stopped outside of the land to send the 12 spies into the land. And although it was only an 11-day journey, it actually took them a month to get there. And then we find the spies were also in the land searching it out for another 40 days. And then we have all the other episodes when they came back. So you'll find that before God cursed them and caused them to wander, virtually 2 years had elapsed. And therefore they were only wandering in the wilderness for 38 years. And therefore it is, on the basis of Deuteronomy chapter 2, spoken of as 38 years, not being the whole time when they came out of Egypt, but the actual time of their wandering in the wilderness where they could find no rest for their souls. Now if you look at Numbers chapter 14 and link it with this, Numbers chapter 14, and verse 2, and all the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, and the whole congregation said unto him, would God that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would God we had died in this wilderness? Wherefore hath the Lord brought us up into this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and our children should be a prey? Were it not better for us to return into Egypt? And they said one to another, let us make a captain and let us return into Egypt. And therefore we find that they wanted to go back into Egypt because they could find no rest for the soles of their feet in all the 38 years wandering in the wilderness. So the 38 years were significant as far as Israel was concerned. When we come back to John chapter 5, it must be with this in mind, that the Master speaks directly to this man, who was symbolic, therefore, of Israel, who, like his predecessors, had wandered for 38 years in the wilderness. This man had had an infirmity for 38 years, finding no cure, finding no ease whatsoever. And the Lord knew that he had been there a long time. And he says to him, wilt thou be made whole? Seems a daft question in one sense. If you'd seen a man with an illness for 38 years, and you knew that he'd had an illness for 38 years, why should the Master says, wilt thou be made whole? You would have thought that it was fairly obvious that that was what the Master, that was what the man wanted from the Master. I think perhaps there's something behind the phrase. Notice the man's response in verse 7. The impotent man answered and said, sir, I have no man when the water is troubled to put me into the pool, but while I am coming, another steppeth down before me. Now just try for a moment, if it's possible, to think that you have been in that state for 38 years. And somebody comes, even if it seems a throwaway line, or it might just be the last sort of thing for you to cling on to, and somebody says, look, do you really want to be cured? I think immediately you'd say, yes, of course I do. It wasn't that sort of response at all. Neither was he abusive. Neither he said, don't be stupid, how can you cure me? It was a very cool, calculated answer. As if the man was prepared in his statement. And therefore I'm going to put to you an either-or situation as far as this man was concerned. That he was one of life's natural sponges. He liked to be looked upon as being a bit of a hard-done-to character. You know, somebody who almost gloried in their infirmity. Someone who wanted to be looked upon as being in pain and suffering and that, so that he could make that the best use of it to his own advantage, so that he could gain both sympathy and perhaps money for him to remain in quite a reasonable state. And therefore he was quite happy with his lot in life. And therefore in verse 7, when the Master had asked him the question, he trotted out his prepared statement. He got no particular reason to leave that environment. Because if he was cured, nobody would have any sympathy for him anymore. And he'd have to work for a living. And there's quite a few people in life who prefer to sponge than to work. And therefore, maybe he was one of those people. Or secondly, that the master was saying, have you really considered of late your sorry state? Don't you think, after 38 years, there's no hope for you whatsoever, no life at all? And that he'd fall into apathy. He'd been in such a sad state for so long, because of the length of his illness, that he'd become listless and had virtually given up. And therefore he didn't think there was any worth, any purpose in living any longer. So when the master says, wilt thou be made whole? He sort of accepted his lot in life, that there was no cure. No money would help him, nobody would put him in the water, and therefore he'd just become resigned to his situation. So that when the master offers him the lifeline, he's basically saying, well, there's no real purpose because nobody's bothered about me, nobody's interested in me whatsoever. And it's interesting that he says in verse 7, sir, I have no man when the water is troubled. So it would seem to suggest that either he'd got no friends at all, nobody to help him whatsoever, or B, he didn't want anybody. Now if you look in Romans chapter 7 for a second, think of the words of the Apostle Paul in verse 24. A wretched man that I am, who shall deliver me from the body of this death? And Paul goes on, I thank God through Jesus Christ our Lord. Now the impotent man was at verse 24, in a very real sense. He was a wretched man in every way. Who would deliver him from the body of this death? But had he by this time become so resigned to his fate that he was no longer interested in life at all? And therefore he'd come to accept that death was his best alternative. It was better for him to die. Now, one writer, if you go back to the prophecy of Ezekiel and chapter 34, have suggested this idea of no man is based upon the idea of Ezekiel 34 concerning the shepherds of Israel. Remember verse 2, prophesy against the shepherds of Israel, prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God unto the shepherds, woe be to the shepherds of Israel that do feed themselves, should not the shepherds feed the flock? Ye eat the fat, ye clothe ye with wool, ye kill them that are fed, but ye feed not the flock. The diseased have you not strengthened, neither have you healed that which was sick, neither have you bound up that which was broken, neither have you brought again that which was driven away, neither have you sought that which was lost, but with force and with cruelty have you ruled them. Now this man had got no man. Where were the priests? They were in the precinct of the temple. Where were the Pharisees? Where were the Sadducees? If there was this moving of the water which could bring a cure, and this man had been there 38 years, why hadn't one of the shepherds of Israel helped those who were in need? And therefore, what he's suggesting was, there was no man, Lord. Nobody here cares about the poor, the blind, the lame, the sick at all. They're so self-sufficient, they only think of themselves, that they have no time for us whatsoever. Now, when we look further on, I'm going to leave it in your minds for a moment, coming back to John chapter 5. When we look further on, we find in verse 10, after the cure had been made, the Jews therefore said unto him that was cured, It is the Sabbath day. It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed. They must have been obviously watching the situation very carefully. So was it a setup? Was this man in league with the Pharisees? Because in verse 14, afterward Jesus findeth him in the temple and said unto him, Behold, thou art made whole. Sin no more, lest a worst thing come unto thee. Why would the master make a comment like that? And immediately in verse 15, the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus which had made him whole. Why should he do that? Why should he tell tales? Why should he immediately go and say to the Jews, and the implication is the Pharisees, those who had criticised the carrying of the bed on the Sabbath day, why should he go and tell them concerning Jesus? Was it because of verse 16 that the Jews therefore sought to persecute Jesus and to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day? It's interesting to think about the fact that they were obviously watching for the cure to take place, because immediately which had made him whole. Why should he do that? Why should he tell tales? Why should he immediately go and say to the Jews, and the implication is the Pharisees, those who had criticised the carrying of the bed on the Sabbath day, why should he go and tell them concerning Jesus? Was it because of verse 16 that the Jews therefore sought to persecute Jesus and to slay him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath day? It's interesting to think about the fact that they were obviously watching for the cure to take place, because immediately the man was made whole, and when he took upon his bed and walked, they went straight up to him and said, it's not lawful for thee to carry the bed. So I think we've got to reconcile in our minds the real essence of this man. Was he genuine, or was he a sponger? Was he really so destitute that no man was there to help him, or was he there really as an ally to the Pharisees to see whether the master would cure on the Sabbath day? If we go back to Jeremiah chapter 17, the principle of being not lawful seems to be taken from this prophecy. Jeremiah chapter 17, from verse 19. Thus saith the Lord unto me, Go and stand in the gate of the children of the people, whereby the kings of Judah come in, and by the which they go out in all the gates of Jerusalem. And say unto them, Hear ye the word of the Lord, ye kings of Judah and all Judah, and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem that enter in by these gates. Thus saith the Lord, Take heed to yourselves, and bear no burden on the Sabbath day, nor bring it in by the gates of Jerusalem, neither carry a burden out of your houses on the Sabbath day, neither do you any work, but hallow the Sabbath day, as I commanded your fathers. Notice, it's the gates of Jerusalem. We're at the sheep gate. The man was carrying a burden on the Sabbath day. And the Jews, the Pharisees, immediately said to him, It is not lawful for thee to carry the bed on the Sabbath day. Now, is it purely coincidental, or was it more of a setup? Can we just reflect back on John chapter 5. It's always good to sort of put the thoughts in your mind and let's see if we can come to any conclusion by going through it. It's obvious the man was singled out. Of all the multitude, he was chosen by the Master for this cure to be made. And therefore, when the Master says in verse 6, "Wilt thou be made whole?" when the man gave his answer in verse 8, Jesus says unto him, "Rise, take up thy bed, and walk." Now, would the Master have cured this man without faith on his part? I would suggest not. I would suggest that the basis of any miracle was faith on the behalf of those who were receiving the blessing. Now again, if we think about Matthew chapter 11 in this regard, and that well known verse 28, when the Master says, "Come unto me, all ye that labour and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest," the Master provided the rest for this man, the relief from the pain, the infirmity, the suffering that he had endured. And therefore it was necessary for the man to respond to the Lord. And immediately we find that the man was made whole. In other words, he was told to do something and he was prepared to do it. Rise up and walk. And he did so. Now that to me suggests an act of faith on behalf of the individual. It showed a response on his part to this cure which the Master was offering to him. 38 years he'd not been able to walk. And then immediately we find he took up his bed and walked. So he must have had a belief in the Master. He must have believed that he was willing or able to effect the cure. He seemed to carry the bed on the Sabbath day himself. It wasn't as if he was giving it the Master to carry so they could sort of catch him out. He was prepared to carry his own bed on the Sabbath day and didn't seem to be even thinking about what he was doing. So relieved, so happy was he in being able to have that cure effected upon him. And therefore in verse 10, when they asked him, "It is not lawful for thee to carry thy bed," he answered them, "He that made me whole, the same said unto me, take up thy bed and walk." Now again, you can read this two ways. Don't blame me for carrying my bed. I'm only carrying out what I've been told to do. If you want to apportion blame to anybody, you go and see the man who's effected the cure. Or you could look at it the other way by saying, you know, "I've just been made whole. The man said to me, take up thy bed and walk. I didn't ask any question. I was so happy, so relieved, so thankful that I could now walk after 38 years. Are you going to be so nitpicking that you're going to worry about me carrying a bed to the temple in order for me to worship God and give my thanks to him? How can someone make me whole unless God was with me, was with him? And therefore, if he told me to carry the bed, then it must be all right. So if you've got an argument at all, have it with him, because I'm sure he'll put you right." Then in verse 12, they asked him, "What man is that which said unto thee, take up thy bed and walk?" And he that was healed wist not who it was, for Jesus had confined himself, a multitude being in that place. Now again, brothers and sisters, you've probably got your own thoughts on verse 13. It's not the first time, it wasn't going to be the last time, when the master was not willing to reveal himself totally to someone who was being cured. Quite often he took himself away very quietly. But the way I look at verse 13, that he conducted himself away from that place very quickly, because the other people of verse 3, the multitude who were in that place, saw the miracle which had been formed and couldn't wait to get hold of the master. They wanted to be cured likewise. They wanted to have a miracle performed on them, and therefore it was like a mob rule. You know, they were clamouring after the master. They wanted to lay hold of him and say, look, cure me as well. But it was not in the master's purpose to do that. Because I believe, brothers and sisters, as I've said, the master wasn't after public acclaim. He wasn't there just to cure people temporarily of an illness, because that would still lead to their eventual death. What he was more concerned about was curing the mind. So if he had to cure the body to impress the principle on the mind, then a miracle would be performed. But unless there was a response from the individual, so they would take hold of the gospel message which the master was prepared to offer, and salvation which would come as a result of that, the actual sensationalism of making somebody whole again was not in the teaching and the ministry of the master. And therefore, he saw in this man, because he knew what was in the heart and mind of every man, a worthiness and therefore a response. Where in the others, all he saw was the wretched, the poor, the blind, the miserable and the lame. And although he could effect a temporary cure, that was not to be the purpose at this moment in time. So he selected one man. For that man who'd got the faith, he was willing to make him whole, and that man was overjoyed as he went into the temple. Then we come to verse 14. When Jesus findeth him in the temple, and said unto him, behold, thou art made whole, sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. Why was he in the temple? Was he there to tell the Pharisees what had happened? Was he there to curry favour with them? Or was he there, like we have suggested, to offer a sacrifice unto the Father, to offer his thanks and his praises for what had been done for him? Why should the master then, in that verse 14, make the comment that he did? Was it the fact that the man had made a mistake? He should have realised that it was unlawful to carry his bed on the Sabbath day. And therefore, because he'd come under the healing grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, because the Lord was prepared to offer him mercy, that didn't give him a license to do whatever he thought that he wanted to do. If you go through to the Epistle to the Romans, this was one of the problems which the Jewish brethren had in the days of the Apostle Paul. Chapter 6 of Romans, and in verse 1. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. How shall we that are dead to sin live any longer therein? There was an attitude amongst Jewish believers that if the forgiveness of sins came by the grace of God, the more they sinned, the more that grace was extended. Therefore, if they continued in sin, then the abundance of grace would be shown even the more. So they thought that they could carry on in their evil ways and still expect to receive the grace and favour of the Almighty. And of course, in one sense, we can sometimes feel that because we can receive the forgiveness of sins, it gives us the license, the liberty to do things which are not right before God. And what I believe the master was underlining here in John chapter 5, look, I know you're overjoyed. I know you are thrilled that you've been made whole and you've come under the auspices of grace. But you've got to still make sure that the small matters are also upheld and done. Whereas that it is unlawful to carry the bed on the Sabbath day, and in one sense, it makes no difference. Don't cause offence for the sake of it. I don't want others not to be able to appreciate what's being done because they're so concentrating on that particular aspect, they're missing the point. And therefore he's saying, behold, thou art made whole, sin no more, lest a worse thing come unto thee. You've still got to now uphold the truth, and in his case, the law, as far as the everyday life was concerned. And therefore, grace did not give him license to do whatever he wanted to do. Or was it, brothers and sisters, that he was confirming the thought that this man was in league with the Pharisee? That the master had said, look, I know what you're up to. I know precisely what's happening. Stop it. Unless a worse thing come upon you. And if it was that, then you'll find that in verse 15, the man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus. And again, the either or. Was he willing to tell them because he confirmed to them that it was the man? There he is. That's the one you've got to take. He caused me to break the Sabbath. He's the one responsible. You go and deal with him. Aren't I a good boy for telling you? And therefore he was again currying favour with the Pharisees. Or was that alternatively that he was so overjoyed to tell everybody who he could about Jesus that he wanted to give him the glory? That's the man. He's the one who's made me whole. He's the reason that I can now walk. He's the one who's brought salvation to me. It's an either-or situation. I'm personally of the persuasion that the man was genuine, that he responded to the Lord by faith. The master was willing to cure him on the basis of that faith. That it was, in one sense, a mistake to carry his bed on the Sabbath day, but that was through being overjoyed and thrilled by the fact that he could walk again after 38 years. He'd gone into the temple to offer sacrifice and to be cleansed according to law, and therefore the master just wanted to remind him that it was not just certain aspects, but the whole of the aspect of law had to be considered and had to be kept up. And therefore he says, make sure you don't turn grace into license and think you can now just do anything you please. You can't. We've still got to uphold the principles of law. And therefore I believe it's on that basis that this was the healing of the impotent man. Now, as far as the type is concerned, I feel we've got in chapter 5 and verse 5 the principle of the 38 years. And therefore I would suggest that it is overall a type concerning natural Israel. Now the problem was, which I had, was what was the grace that was extended to them as far as the curing or being made whole was concerned? Now, I'm going to make a suggestion that the five porches of Bethesda, the house of mercy and the house of kindness, refer to the five books of Moses, the law, as far as they were concerned. And that law had been there in place, but the great multitude did not avail themselves of the benefit of that law. As far as they were concerned, it didn't bring them a hope of life. And therefore the law could not save. So although they'd come under the auspices, the house of kindness, the principle of law, they were still in verse 3 in an impotent state. And therefore it needed the grace and mercy of God to be shown to them through the Lord Jesus Christ before they could be cured. And then if we take the principle on, When the Jewish believers then, who had come under the auspices of grace and truth as preached by Jesus, they still wanted to associate themselves again with the temple and with the things of the law. So they were told by the apostles, make sure now you don't go back to that way unless a worse thing come upon you. Now again, it doesn't fit exactly, it's not a clear type. As far as we're concerned, I think it's a fairly obvious, straightforward lesson that we can be cured by responding to God's mercy. That no man can cure themselves. That no other man can, as it were, dip us into the water to be cured. There is only one way under heaven whereby we might be saved, and that's through the waters of baptism centred in the Lord Jesus Christ. And therefore it's upon that basis and that basis only that we can be healed of our infirmities. I think that's a very straightforward and very obvious lesson. It's the one which reflects on the Jews, which, as I say, is more difficult in my mind anyway, to get the actual overall thing, because you go one direction and something doesn't fit, you go down another direction and something else doesn't fit. But as I say, my conclusion was that it was representing Israel as a nation who were impotent, who were not able to be cured by the law, by the first, you know, five porches, the five books of Moses, and they had to wait for the saving grace to come in the person of the Lord Jesus Christ to be made whole. It was only on that basis that they could indeed effect a real cure. So that's my view. I must confess, I find it a difficult one. Perhaps I've looked for problems where there shouldn't be, but I've tried to be honest to the text. It's, to me, not an easy one at all. And therefore, you know, I've put the either or to you. Maybe you'd like to think about it, and we're going to discuss it in a few moments. I'd just like to conclude by looking at verse 16. Therefore did the Jews persecute Jesus and sought to slay him because he had done these things on the Sabbath day. I presume the things that they were talking about is that he had cured and he had told a man that he could carry his bed on the Sabbath day. And therefore it was not only what he had done himself, but what he was saying to others, which was a reason for them to persecute him, because basically he was causing insurrection. He was causing people to be turned against them as leaders and the things that they stood for. And therefore the Sabbath day was going to frequently come up in conversation with the Jewish hierarchy, and it was that more than anything else they were going to try and pin on him every time, that he was a Sabbath breaker. Now in conclusion then, brothers and sisters, I think we ought to just go to Hebrews chapter 4. Because when the writer to the Hebrews later on was speaking about the rest that remaineth for the people of God, you remember verse 9, I'm sure, there remaineth therefore the margin, a keeping of a Sabbath to the people of God. He goes on to say, he that is entered into his rest, he hath also ceased from his own works as God did from his. Let us therefore labour to enter into that rest, lest any man fall after the same example of unbelief. The rest of the Sabbath was not putting their feet up and doing nothing. The idea was they were ceasing from their daily toil, from the things of the flesh, from the things of hard labour, in order that they may on that day commit themselves totally to God. And of course the act of healing, the act of helping someone, was very much in the spirit of working for God on the Sabbath day. And therefore it was a total misunderstanding of the Sabbath day law which caused the conflict between the master and the hierarchy. But we want to bear in mind this Sabbath day because it keeps cropping up, as we've said, and they thought that above everything was the means whereby they could condemn him before the people, because he openly allowed people to break the Sabbath.